We highlight a fifth-generation South Dakota rodeo business from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Today is Monday, June 14th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Steve and Brent Sutton of Sutton Rodeo Company. We'll talk about stock contracting, competing, and South Dakota rodeo traditions. U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson joins us with his thoughts on the Great American Infrastructure Debate. We'll also ask him about what the cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline project means for the future of infrastructure development. We get to know Scott Simpson for today's segment on old guitars and the local musicians who love them. Plus, first tracks from David Hirschroot is later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Dakota Access Oil Pipeline opponents have asked a federal judge to require detailed monthly status reports while the federal government conducts an extensive environmental review. The request comes after Judge James Boasberg ruled last month that the pipeline may continue operating while the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers conducts the review. Boasberg ordered the parties involved in the litigation to go over the next steps they plan to take. Pipeline attorneys told the court they shouldn't have to provide status reports and renewed their longstanding request to have the case dismissed. The South Dakota National Guard has a new state-of-the-art readiness center in Rapid City. Soldiers, state officials, and builders are celebrating the $20 million structure. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more.
Captain John Barnes grew up visiting the National Guard building at the Rapid City Airport with his father, and he's used the crowded facility during his 13 and a half years as a pilot. He says the new Army Aviation Readiness Center is a much-needed addition to the older building.
I think I'm most excited for the extra space, the offices, and the classrooms. That has always been the hardest part of Drillist, because we always have a ton of mandatory training, and there's not enough space for everyone.
The building has storage areas, a gym, and a vehicle maintenance bay. Major General Jeff Marlette is the leader of the South Dakota National Guard.
From a perspective of just the building itself, it's aesthetically very nice. I mean, it's bright, it's modern.
Governor Kristi Noem says the building sends a message that South Dakota supports its National Guard.
It says to everybody who sees this facility, hears about it, is that we support our troops. Here, we back them, and we back them by making sure that you have the type of facilities and the equipment that you need to do the job.
The eco-friendly structure was funded with $15 million from the federal government and $5 million from the state. For SDPB, I'm Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
Yankton and Lawrence counties are now part of an automated breathalyzer system for their 24/7 sobriety programs. People on parole after a drunk driving charge can use a kiosk for their required sobriety check. SDPB's Kyle Ireland reports.
The kiosks in the sheriff's department let someone on parole take a self-serve sobriety test. That means deputies and jailers don't need to use handheld breathalyzer equipment. Patrick McKinney is the general manager of Precision Kiosk Technologies. It's the company responsible for the automated test. He says the new system keeps people safe.
In this particular time where we're worried about COVID propagation and we want to mitigate people's potential exposure and be very wary of their health, you hold up the personal breathalyzer test and a person blows in that device.
McKinney says the personalized test means law enforcement personnel don't have someone breathing on them. It also gives them time for other duties.
They're not taking a test and recording data. They're managing their people through this process, and they can interact with the people in a way that's more positive and beneficial.
McKinney says they've gotten feedback from people taking the test who like its convenience.
You know, I can park, I can come in, I can take my test, I can leave, and I'm done.
Yankton and Lawrence counties are the latest to enroll in the program. Breathalyzer kiosks can test up to 40 people in an hour, and law enforcement can access the data from any computer or smartphone. Reporting for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
Highs today are in the upper 80s to the lower 90s. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The 105th class of Pulitzer Prize winners in journalism, books, drama, and music were announced on Friday. Editorial cartoonist Marty Tubbles Sr. was one of three finalists for the Editorial Cartooning Prize. Tubbles is Oglala Lakota and originally from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. He's the uncle of SDPB's Richard Tubbles. Congratulations to Marty Tubbles. Congratulations also goes out to author Louise Erdrich, who has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for her book, The Night Watchman. It's a novel about one community's efforts to halt the proposed displacement and elimination of several Native American tribes in the 1950s. I spoke with Louise Erdrich before the announcement back in April. Here she is describing inspiration for the book.
The book is set in 1953 and 54. I was born in 1954, and at that time, my grandfather, who had an eighth grade education, government boarding school education, in fact, he went to boarding school in Wahpeton, North Dakota, where I grew up. He wrote these wonderful letters to my parents. This was also during the time that he was fighting a policy that had been put into place called termination. He didn't write a lot about termination. I was surprised when I looked at the letters more carefully. He had written about family and the huge truck garden that supported them and his job as a night watchman. But he always talked in those letters about his exhaustion. He was always writing them at night. And sometimes he would talk about the fact that during the day, he did meetings all day to find ways to fight this bill. And we'll talk about what this bill was that was agreed to by Congress. The inspiration for me to write this book came from really going back and putting the timeline of my own birth, the background, my mother's pregnancy, and his life against the history of termination and his exhaustion. And I realized what an incredible task had been before him and how he had measured himself against that task, and how he had done something incredible by the end of the book. He brought other people into his mission. He made friends across aisles of every sort. You know, he was a great raconteur. He was a storyteller. He was funny. He was extremely intelligent. He was also very well read, and they managed to defeat termination. There were five tribes scheduled on the first list to be terminated. Turtle Mountain Reservation was on that list. And of those five, this was the only tribe to escape termination. And it became, I think, an inspiration for other tribes because it looked like a foregone conclusion. We should really talk about what termination was. So this was 1940s to 50s. You know, this didn't happen all at once, but this was post-war United States. Huge housing boom, right? And corporations saw these resources, specifically the timber on the Menominee, on the Klamath reservations. Don't honestly know why Turtle Mountains was on the list, because we have a very small reservation. It was reduced from 20 townships to only two, so it was very small, but it was on the list. But termination was brought to Native people under a very different set of terms. Termination was kind of a hidden motive sort of bill. What it was saying was, this will liberate you. This bill will take the government off your back. This bill it was going to abrogate treaties. It was going to declare all treaties null and void, right? And that way, nobody would have a land base. There would be no reservations. But the fact of it is, the treaties are the supreme law of the land. And there's a lot of confusion about treaties. Treaties were not handouts by the government. Let's just be sure that that's not a thought. Treaties were desperately fought for by Native nations. In the beginning, these treaties they're in the Constitution, and only the United States government can make treaties with Native nations. I mean, it was a government-to-government relationship, which exists to this day. So declaring these treaties null and void was an absolutely vast consequences for Native people.
That's author and Pulitzer Prize winner Louise Erdrich. I spoke with her in April. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie, sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of SDPB. The Sound Vision campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
Program funding is provided by Reptile Gardens, beautiful botanical gardens and an indoor jungle full of tropical flowers and plants in the Guinness Book of World Records for the world's largest reptile zoo. For unforgettable memories today, reptilegardens.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Negotiations are still underway in Washington regarding President Biden's proposal for an American infrastructure bill. The president and Republican leaders in Congress have paused those negotiations officially. Meanwhile, the bipartisan and bicameral group called the Problem Solvers Caucus is developing their own infrastructure proposal. South Dakota's lone representative in the U.S. House is part of that caucus. I spoke with U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson this morning.
Well, the Problem Solvers Caucus hasn't been around that long, just a few years, but it's 29 Democrats and 29 Republicans that are kind of fed up of the, you know, the party line way of thinking. I think we acknowledge, I mean, listen, we're proud Democrats and proud Republicans, but we understand that to cut a deal, you really do have to find some common ground. Anybody who's been involved in a marriage or a business or a nonprofit or a church, I think, understands they don't get their way all the time. We've been frustrated, frankly, by the way that some of the parties are talking past each other on infrastructure. This has traditionally, Lori, been a huge area of bipartisan agreement. Every single highway bill we've ever passed into law has been passed with lots of Democrat and lots of Republican votes. The bills have always been negotiated with those folks sitting at the table on the very first day. We've gotten away from that, and the problem solvers are trying to put that genie back in the bottle.
Tell me a little bit about your plan, the Building Bridges plan.
Yeah, by and large, rejects the president's expansive definition of infrastructure, and that's no disrespect to him, but words have to have some meaning, and if you just decide infrastructure now means anything that you think is important, then you kind of get this ridiculous, end product. And frankly, voters are kind of sick of these massive bills that include lots of unrelated provisions. So we really focused on hard physical infrastructure, on capital assets. There are a few exceptions here and there, but by and large, we focus on things that you think of when you hear infrastructure, roads, bridges, waterways, broadband. Those are the kind of things that are clearly governmental, you know, a central government's role, and have been for a long time. You know, the price tag is larger than some of the Republicans are talking about, certainly larger than I've talked about in the past, a lot smaller than what the president is talking about. Of course, that's the nature of finding common ground. I think one big difference, though, the price tag isn't as big as it looks, because instead of spending over 5 years, which would be traditional for a highway bill, we're spending over 8 years. We think there's some political benefits to that, too.
How big is that cost? And is it new cost or above the baseline of what you would normally spend? Help people sort through what exactly you think the price tag could be with this plan.
Yeah, over 8 years, we spend $1.2 trillion. And so if you think about that over the terms of a five-year spending plan, that's more like $700 billion. You know, I have proposed, along with ranking member Sam Graves from Missouri, he's the top Republican on the Transportation Committee, he and I have proposed a package of about $500 billion over 5 years. And so coming up to $700 billion is not the kind of thing that I'm excited about. But obviously, it's a lot smaller than the $2.3 trillion that President Biden is talking about.
How do you offset those costs? How do you pay for it?
Well, we had three steps to this process. Step number one was releasing an infrastructure report, which we did a few weeks ago. That analyzed the need and then highlighted what we were going to pay for. Number two was to put a price tag on those things. Okay, if we need X amount of bridges and Y amount of road, what does that cost us? Step three, which we're working on now, are the pay-fors, which is how do you generate the revenue? And, you know, I think that'll be the most difficult area to get agreement on. There are basically three camps, Lori. There are those who want to do something really new. The president has proposed raising corporate taxes and a variety of other taxes to pay for it. That has not been done before. Traditionally, highways, bridges, those have been paid for by gas tax. It's been a user fee-based system. The user pays for the system. Number two are people who want to increase the gas tax, as traditionally would be done, to pay for it. And then number three, there are folks who just want to borrow all the money because raising taxes is hard and is politically not popular. And I think those three camps are probably divided about one-third, one-third, one-third. It's going to be really hard to get 50% in the House and 60 votes in the Senate on anything.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about some of, you know, when we think of the future of American infrastructure and we talk about electric vehicle framework and green energy sources and the electric grid, talk a little bit about what you are looking at as what's necessary for the future.
Well, the good news is I think we have an opportunity to grow into a solution. Of course, electric vehicles are here, but they're not here in the kinds of numbers that are particularly disruptive yet. And frankly, it's going to be a long time. The kind of investment that would be needed to have electric vehicles, even just one on every block, is mind-boggling. It makes the price tag of our, you know, roads and bridges piece of this look relatively small. That's not going to happen overnight, but also, you know, we have a really long tail on these technologies. I mean, the internal combustion engine is going to be around for a long time, and even if we quit making them today, we've got, you know, these hundreds of millions of vehicles on the road, and they're not going anywhere right away. So I think we've got an opportunity, rather than to react in a dramatic way, to say, okay, what do we think long-term this looks like? And I'm not a very big fan of having a device in the car that would monitor people's movement. There are some people say electric vehicles need to pay their fair share of gas tax. I certainly think they need to pay their fair share. But, you know, having a device in every American car, kind of getting rid of the gas tax and then go to a vehicle's miles driven device in the car, that just, I think that's going to be a hard sell. It feels pretty Big Brother-ish. And so I think we're just going to have to keep the gas tax for the liquid fuel side. And for the electric vehicle side, I think we can do a registration fee, monthly or annual fee. South Dakota has done that. A number of states have done that. Wouldn't be hard to imagine that could work on the federal level. And that way, everybody would be able to pay their fair share.
Mm-hmm. What do farmers and producers need to be thinking about when it comes to sort of carbon capture framework for the future? Are there ways that they need to be considering that now for what might come out of Washington in the days ahead?
Well, part of the difficulty is that South Dakota producers have been on the cutting edge of this. You know, you look at, you know, a few different smart farming practices, the use of cover crops and a no-till approach to farming. Those really both help carbon. They're good for soil health as well and air health generally. They're really good practices. South Dakota farmers, to a far greater extent than most across the country, have already adopted those in a big way. So when you put together, when the Biden administration talks about a carbon bank or providing new revenues for farmers to do the right thing, we want to make sure that they don't punish the early adapters. And that can make any package quite a little bit more expensive because you're not just paying people to change their behavior in the future. You're also trying to take care of the people who did the right thing 2 and 5 and 10 years ago. That is going to be one of the many details that I think make it difficult to for a carbon bank that the Biden administration envisions, for it to come together very quickly, at least. Hmm.
Any thoughts on the closing of the Keystone XL pipeline project and how that influences this entire infrastructure conversation in Washington?
Well, I think it's going to make it more difficult to convince people to invest in large infrastructure projects. We have a tendency to talk in D.C. a lot about, you know, particularly because money's tight, nobody likes raising taxes. So they talk about public-private partnerships. And I'm actually not a very big fan of those in the context of, you know, highways and bridges. I don't particularly like toll roads. The idea of turning over this piece of governmental infrastructure to the private sector so that they can monetize it. You know, maybe it's just the rural American in me, but I don't love that. I just want to pay for my highways at the pump and drive on them as I please. But we have lots and lots of urban areas that have monetized that through a partnership with the private sector. Private sector will make these large, new, robust investments in that infrastructure that the government is unwilling or unable to do. I don't know, when we're in a position where 10 years after the overwhelming majority of environmental reviews have been conducted by judges and environmental scientists, have received the approval, have met their burden of proof under the law. 10 years after that happens, that somebody can come along and in essence issue a super veto over a project without an evidentiary record to rely on in that particular decision. I just think people aren't in the business of making billion-dollar wagers with that kind of uncertainty. So I am a little nervous about what that's going to mean just for the rule of law and investment. But, you know, ultimately people are concerned long-term about liquid fuel and hopefully South Dakota farmers can step up and grow even more corn and we can have even more ethanol that helps to offset the loss of what would have come from Canada.
Very briefly, before we let you go, what's next with this? Do you see the Problem Solvers Caucus having influence in this conversation or, you know, gaining traction with at least, if not some of the details of your plan, but overall with this notion of pushing for more bipartisanship in the infrastructure conversation?
Well, the Problem Solvers are unusual in D.C. So much of what happens in D.C. is people make a lot of noise, but they haven't, and their desire is to get the attention, right? There are a lot of show horses in D.C. rather than workhorses. Well, the people who actually get things done often are not spending that much time making noise. That's been true for the Problem Solvers. I mean, what you see is just a fraction of the effort that we've done. This is not only bipartisan, it's also bicameral. That is to say that we've been actively talking to senators as well. And there's a certain amount of this that is staged. I mean, have the House plan out there publicly, have that sort of normalized, have people begin to talk about it. Then the Senate, I mean, people like Bill Cassidy and Joe Manchin can begin to put more meat on this these bones. They can begin to talk with the White House. I mean, I think we're moving in that direction. You know, the next legislative step that would need to happen is I think we need to get 60 votes in the Senate. And if we could get 60 votes in the Senate, then I think we've got a better than fighting chance of being able to get those votes in the House.
I spoke with U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson this morning. He was in Mitchell at the time of our conversation. Ahead on the program, the June SDPB Spotlight shines on South Dakota rodeo traditions. We'll talk with Steve and Brent Sutton next. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of SDPB. The Sound Vision campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
Miss something on SDPB? Sign up for the SDPB Morning Report. Get the reporting you love straight to your email twice a week. Go more in depth with our statewide coverage, and don't miss critical segments from shows like In the Moment and South Dakota Focus. It's the news you can use, free from clutter, and best of all, free of charge. To sign up for the Morning Report, visit sdpb.org/news and scroll to the bottom.
Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In June, the SDPB Spotlight shines on South Dakota's rodeo traditions. You can find all our rodeo stories online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Today, we welcome Steve Sutton and Brent Sutton of the Sutton Rodeo Company for a conversation about their lives in rodeo as stock contractors, competitors, and South Dakotans. This is a sixth-generation ranching family, and they are joining us on the phone from Oneida. Steve Sutton, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Brent, thanks for being here as well.
Hello, Lori. Thanks for having us.
Steve, tell us a little bit about your operation and how it connects with the rodeo all these generations.
Well, our great-grandpa had his first rodeo in 1926 on the ranch, and we've been, you know, in every aspect of the rodeo business, from professional all the way down to 4-H and little britches. In 2026, we will be in the business 100 years.
Wow. So, Steve, do you remember, did you know your great-grandpa? What are some of your earliest rodeo memories?
Not my great-grandpa, but my grandpa was around when, in the 60s and 70s, you know, I remember most of the 70s. I was in high school and started picking up rodeos then, and actually even being sent off. Me and another high school kid used to go off on a couple of our busy weekends and produce a rodeo by ourselves, you know, and Grandpa had, you know, advice from the production all the way down to caring for him year round.
Wow. Yeah, when I was that age, I could barely hold down a job at the Dairy Queen, keep myself organized. So that's pretty impressive. Brent, tell me some of your earliest memories of sort of being in this family and some of the early, your relationship with rodeo. It must just be interwoven to everything in your life.
I guess some of the earliest memories would be just working at the rodeos. We were pretty much at one every weekend in the summer and few in the winter time too, but either loading calves and steers, helping produce the rodeo. Some of my favorite early memories were, you know, picking up rodeos with my dad. I've always wanted to be just like him and be a pickup man, and so that's some of the most memorable things from early on. But yeah, just pretty much work, and the best part to me about raising bucking horses and getting to grow up and see that is not necessarily at the rodeo, but home on the ranch too. Seeing a herd of 100 head of horses running over the hills, pretty neat.
Brent, you're not just a pickup man, you're a national level pickup man. Tell us a little bit about your work as a pickup man and where it's taking you.
So last year I got pretty lucky and was able to work the NFR. I still got a ways to go to catch up to Dad. He got to do it 5 times. But that's been a dream come true. I've wanted to, you know, grow up and be just like Dad, but not just that. I dreamt of going to the NFR, so I finally got to check that off my bucket list last year. And I mean, being a pickup man is pretty rewarding to me. I mean, there's nothing like the natural ability of a bucking horse. It's always fascinated me and impressed me. And being a pickup man, you get to be right out there with them when they're doing what they do best. And you're an aid to the cowboy and to the bucking horse, and, you know, for safety. And it's just the best seat in the house, and it's a pretty good job to have.
Steve, it must feel good to hear your son say that he wants to be like his dad. Tell me a little bit about your experience as a pickup man and what you see in your son that makes him effective.
Well, he commented about the best seat in the house, and that definitely is. You're in the action. The seat you're sitting on was the horses that we use. I always give credit of 95% of our success of our job was if we were mounted good. Brent can actually get along on maybe on a bronkier horse or not as broke good horse for picking up, and you'd never know it. He makes them look so smooth. I wasn't maybe as good a cowboy, I want to say, but we also had a lot more horses to pick up in the 70s. You know, me in June alone, I'd pick up 1,000 head of horses. And you know, with the way as many rodeos that now are on, I don't know if Brent gets to see 1,000 bucking horses in, you know, 2 or 3 months in the summer.
Wow. I want to talk a little bit about the stock contracting or the breeding of these horses. And I'm not sure which one of you wants to start out with that. But, Steve, help people understand how these horses are prepared for what the rest of us see as, you know, an 8-second, you know, performance, if you will.
Well, you know, it's just like in the racehorse world or the Western pleasure world, the bloodlines mean a lot. We really take pride in raising our bucking horses. And I made the comment last year or 2 years ago. Last year was kind of an off year, but in all our pro rodeos, we hauled 67 different horses, and all but one of them were raised here on the ranch. You know, this is a special time of year for me. And when May 1st comes, I've got little pastures around my house, and I've got 60 mares and colts in 6 different pastures. And I can see them all from the house, and I see these babies born and run around and then playing, and then down the road get to watch them maybe throw their first cowboy off when they're 3 years old. You know, it's pretty special to me. But the bloodlines, and, you know, it's very important in the rodeo world too. So you don't just stop and start. I mean, we've been breeding bucking horses for 100 years, and it would take at least 40 years if I wanted to start from scratch to get it where it is right now.
Brent, help us understand one of those colts and what a great image that is. How does a colt like that get from those early days to throwing the first cowboy? Like, what happens in between that? Yeah.
It's if you like immediate results, raising bucking horses is probably not for you because it takes a long time. Like you said, you know, you pick the mare and the stud to go together, and then you pretty much wait for 4 years until you even get to see if you made the right decision. But in the meantime, you get to see them kind of grow, mature. We start out, it's a mechanical dummy is usually how we start them, and you know, it's a lot more controlled than having a human rider. And if they're a smaller animal, a smaller horse, it's it's better to start them out with that because you can control when the dummy falls off and you kind of help them learn how to get rid of it. But it's with the bucking horse too. I mean, you can't teach it. It's just, it's natural. They know what they're doing. You're just kind of helping as a guide to help them along the way. And I can't really, I guess, it's kind of like raising a child, you know, taking them to youth wrestling deals or then on the high school wrestling tournaments. I mean, you're just kind of there along the way to help them, put them into situations that will let them learn and then sit back and watch them, you know, in action when it all comes together.
That is fascinating. So whose side are you on during that 8 seconds? Are you kind of hoping for the throw? You're hoping for the points because the points are added together. Like how, when you're watching a ride with one of your horses, what are you thinking?
Oh, it's like picture perfect ride. The rider has to be, you know, in time and doing well too. So you want the cowboy to do well. I mean, it's fun to see you dust some of your pals every once in a while, but that'd be tough. It all depends on the matchup. You know, sometimes it's fun to watch a horse get a guy, so the next time they draw him, there's that much more storyline into the end result of what happens. Never hope bad for anybody, no, but it's the classic event of rodeos, bronc riding, and you know, good cowboy and a good horse, there's nothing better to see on a Saturday night or Wednesday or whatever. It's pretty picture perfect when it all works out.
Yeah. Steve, what did you learn from your father or your grandfather or the people who taught you that you think has always been something you've carried with you as you do this work?
Well, you know, disease is like a person, a horse, anybody. You take care of them. You know, I usually fed the horses every morning before I ate breakfast and hauling them. Some could go to 10 rodeos in a row and be fine, and others, you know, after four, they needed to go back to ranch and rest a little bit. And to the longevity is you got to make it last a long time, you've got to take care of them. And we've really strived at taking care of the animal, and to add to what Brent just said, you know, yes, it used to be you wanted to buck them all off. Now it's you want them to give the cowboy enough points so he can win a check. And it costs a lot to go up and down the road. If you got one that's going to throw them off, they're not going to make any money. So, you know, I've went in my time from wanting to throw them off to wanting them to have a horse under them enough for them to win that check.
This is a great time of year, and I'm so enjoying this month of June talking rodeo and getting to know people. Please come back anytime, and we will talk again. Steve Sutton and Brent Sutton with Sutton Rodeo, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having us.
Let's take a moment now and be blown away by South Dakota's rich history. On Saturday, June 15th in 1924, a massive windstorm swept across the state. There were reports of more than a dozen deaths, along with property and livestock losses extending from south central through the eastern parts of the state. Known as the South Dakota Wind Storm, the storm killed 8 members of one family southeast of Chamberlain and 2 more people near White Lake. Newspaper reports told of considerable wind and hail damage to buildings, sheep and cattle were lost, and flax and wheat crops were flattened. Additional storm-related deaths were reported in Pierre, Eagle Butte, Falkton, Miller, and Highmore. As the wind storm moved east, 2 people died near Salem when a barn collapsed, and a downed power line killed a woman in Canton. Wire communications were cut in the Mitchell area, isolating the community and causing a lag in storm damage reporting. Telephone and telegraph companies spent several weeks restoring communications. Most of the devastation was caused by powerful straight-line winds, but the storm also spawned a tornado near Wessington Springs, causing property and crop damage throughout the area. A catastrophic windstorm rips through South Dakota 97 years ago this week. Production assistance for our South Dakota history segments comes from Dr. Brad Tennant. He's professor of history at Presentation College. Ahead on the program, old guitars and the local musicians who love them. We hear from Scott Simpson and how an instrument can bond people across generations. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of SDPB. The Sound Vision Campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision Campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision Campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
I'm Robin Young. A new cancer DNA blood test tells doctors whether most tumors have returned months before scans can and before those tumors can grow.
Prior to this test, everybody was in the same scenario. After surgery, you might or might not have cells left, and we don't know that. But now we can see the invisible.
That's next time, here and now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Scott Simpson is an educator, poet, musician, and songwriter with some 29 albums to his credit. He describes his music as folk, rock, jazz, Americana. The list goes on from there. Simpson released his first album more than 20 years ago with the title Ozzy's Guitar. And yes, there is a story there. SDPB producer Brian Gevick joins me now from SDPB's Vermilion Studios for another segment of Old Guitars and the Local Musicians Who Love Them. Hey, Brian, welcome.
Oh, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Scott Simpson was one of my favorite In the Moment of Sound, In Moment in Sound guests, so I'm so glad to hear that you talked to him, too. For people who missed some of those early conversations, tell us something about Scott.
Well, for one thing, he lives in Spearfish Canyon. He has a studio in his home. He performs mainly on pluck string instruments like the guitar, the mandolin, and the ukulele. He records and performs with other people, including his family members. And as you mentioned in the intro, Scott's a guy with some really diverse skills, and he's very articulate in the way that he expresses his thoughts in music and also his thoughts about songwriting and poetry and music altogether.
Yeah, and sound. He just brings in the sound of something that's, and makes it music. I love that part. Tell us about this guitar, Ozzy's guitar.
Well, actually, I'm going to let Scott do that mainly, but I will tell you that it's an old guitar. It's got a great deal of sentimental value to Scott and his family. Now, he's going to play a part of the song on the guitar that song is about, okay? Mm. So he's going to play Ozzy's guitar on Ozzy's guitar. And I'll tell you going in that as we were recording and after Scott finished playing, I had this strong sense that there was kind of like a friendly ghost in the room, and Scott comments on that at the end.
Ozzy was my wife's grandfather, Ozzy Leslie, and he was a colorful character who did a lot of work a lot of different places, and what my wife told me about is he would always come to visit. He drove this El Camino. And he'd have all his bags in the back, and he had he always had this guitar, and he would come and he would tell the stories. They'd catch him up on what he'd been doing in places that he'd been, and then he would sing a few songs to the kids and stuff, and before they went to bed and all of that. But they, listening to my wife, he was this adventurer. And the guitar represented that. So when we got married, I always noticed this guitar sitting in the corner. It was this guitar. Ozzy had, it's a classical guitar, should have had nylon strings on it all along, but Ozzy had put steel strings because that's the sound he wanted. And so steel strings on a classical guitar kind of wears it out after a while. It was beat up at the time. And my wife's parents said, hey, would you guys like this? Because they knew I was a musician. I said, yeah, that'd be great. So I took it home, restrung it, and my wife was telling me about these stories. And so that's when I wrote the song, Ozzy's Guitar. Ozzy drove an El Camino, cuffed the hems of his Navy chinos, man alive. Could Grandpa drive? Odd jobs from here to Reno, living light, heck if we know how or why. But he was alive. Every time that Ozzy'd come around, his bags were dusty with the gravel roads of a thousand little towns. We saw the world, we traveled far on the silver strings of Ozzy's guitar. Music in so many cultures is not only about who's physically present in the room. Music, whether you're talking about hymns, whether you're talking about sacred songs of the Lakota, Dakota people, whether you're talking about even symphonies that evoke another place, another time, I think music has that capacity to connect us with something and someone beyond just right here in the physical presence, you know.
That is a great experience to be a part of. I got a little chills just listening to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Ozzy's guitar, there's more to the story. They were in a flood. They got out of the house. Everybody was fine. But Ozzy's guitar actually was floating for a while, and Scott had to kind of piece it back together. So it's remarkable that it's playable at all. I think it's just a great sense of you've got this thing that belonged to somebody else, and you hear the sound that they heard. I just really had a good time talking with Scott.
And then you keep it going. Tell me just a little bit before we let you go about what Scott Simpson is really doing now. You know, he plays, he records, he does other projects as well.
Well, he's still involved in education. He's a former teacher, and he's still involved in various educational projects. And, you know, he's still playing here and there. He's been writing songs. I believe he has another album coming out, which I think should make it about 30. He's been writing songs since even before he could play. He's been writing songs since he was a little kid. I should mention also that we talked for quite a while, and if you're interested, there's a full transcript of our conversation and the full version of Ozzy's Guitar on our website at www.sdpb.org/music.
Where are you going next for this project, Brian? Are you following where the guitar music leads you next?
Well, we are, pardon me, I have a couple more people lined up, including Nick Schwabach from here in Vermilion, who plays a great old guitar from 1949 and plays music appropriate to that. And I'm hoping to connect with an old bandmate of his, Boyd Bristow, somebody that a lot of people know around here, and somebody that's, you know, also been playing professionally for many years. And we hope to have him in the studio in the next few weeks.
Brian Gevick, this was a really good idea. I say it every week, but I look forward to it every week. Yeah. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Lori.
David Herzrud from Sturgis is listening to new music releases every week. He's a former marketing director for Warner Brothers EMI Music, and he's a lifelong music enthusiast. He's amassed a vinyl CD and MP3 collection worth admiration. And for this segment of First Tracks, he took a few minutes to talk with SDPB's Larry Rohr.
We're here with David Herzrud from Sturgis. Taking a little time away from the family business, David spent several years with Warner Brothers Elektra Atlantic Music, but he's been a lifelong music nut. He's surrounded by his 15,000-plus vinyl album collection, another 80,000-plus digitized MP3s, also brought you CDTV, a review in Rapid City Market and beyond for several years, and time to check in with David again to see what new and what you've been listening to. One of those that you mentioned this time around is a new album from the Black Keys, Delta Cream.
This is their 10th album. These are basically blues cover songs from basically the Hills Country bluesmen like John Lee Hooker, Fred McDowell, Junior Kimbrough, and Robert Lee Burnside.
Well, I'm a crawling Kingston.
When you're going in to record an album, it takes a long time. You know, you could spend weeks, maybe even months in the studio getting the production done. The Black Keys recorded this album over 2 days and 2 afternoons. So that gives you an idea of how tuned in these two guys are to the music.
Yeah, I'ma crawl up to your window, crawl up to your door, see anything I want to be, crawl up on your door, see me coming, crawl up on your door.
When I heard Crawling Kingsnake, pulled that up and was listening to it, I said, you know, this is something I've got to get my hands on.
Let's jump over to a group I have not heard of, and that is The Middle Kids. They've got an album, We're the Greatest, and you picked out questions from that, but this group is from Australia.
And there have always been some really fascinating bands coming out of Australia, whether it be AC/DC, Tame Impala, INXS used to start going down the line ever since, you know, kind of Australian music started breaking through with the Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind, and the Bee Gees. This group has been around since about 2016, 2017. They released their first album in 2017.
And I got questions, and you got answers, and I'm not sure if they're even worth asking.
Elton John heard the album and just became totally excited about the group and became probably their biggest champion. And when you have something like Sir Elton on your side and how talking you up, all of a sudden people are going to start paying attention.
With the thumbs down, the king is shaking his head, calling for our arrest. And I got questions, and you got answers, and I'm not sure if they're fact or fiction. And I got questions, and you got answers, and I'm not sure if they're even worth asking.
This is one of those groups where you listen to the first album, you hear one thing, and you listen to the second album, and I think there have been a couple of EPs in their interim. But you hear the second album and you go that this is a band that's growing musically.
The Bare Naked Ladies are back. They've got the new album from Tour de Force.
They're one of my favorite bands. Always been a big believer, and anything they come out with, I'm going to listen to. But this is going to be their 16th album, and it's going to be their first new music in 4 years.
Am I living in a bubble? Am I really out of touch? Do you think I'll get in trouble if I talk too much? Am I too cynical, a bit too clinical? Maybe that pinnacle's unwinnable, subliminal, original sin. You'll tell me where you've been. Can we get a do-over and start again?
And this is a group that kind of defies description. They try just about everything. Mixed rock, pop, they'll delve into hip-hop, some rap. They're unique and different. If you're a Bare Naked Ladies fan, kind of like a cult following. But these are the guys who wrote the theme music for the Big Bang Theory. They're very literate. Music's very intelligent. I mean, you're going to hear, you know, lyrics they put together that you're just probably not going to hear on a lot of other albums. They also have a tremendous sense of humor, which I totally enjoy.
Because we believe it, it doesn't make it so, so, so. Come on, flip, bend a little bit, maybe get wise to a new tip. Come on, flip, take a little trip, see another side of the same ship. This is the church.
You can find all the first tracks with David Herzrud conversations on our website at sdpb.org.